Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Conference on World Affairs, which is almost as old as I am. This is panel number 4608, Chinese Scholars Take on Climate Change. It's 2 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, and we're going to have a wonderful presentation here today by four young Chinese women who are in the United States studying and working with our researchers. In this session, we're going to utilize a note card system to retrieve questions from you. You may raise your hand at any time to request a note card, so just put your hand up in the air and a pencil. You will also get one of the producers will give that to you. Then please write your question and raise it up, and they will collect that from you as well, and then we will have all of the questions here. So at any time during the presentation, just raise your hand and you will get a note card. My name is Anne Bliss. I'm retired from the program of writing and rhetoric.
Farther from it.
Okay.
There you go.
Can you hear?
No.
A little bit closer.
Can you hear now? Thank you so much. We'll try to get the microphone under control. We didn't get the big one, so we're playing with a local baby one here today. I'd like to introduce our speakers to you. I will do so in the order in which they will present, and after each speaker, I will introduce the others. All of them are wonderful young scientists from China, and they're here working on our campus and at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Our first speaker this afternoon is Ruixia Guo. She's a PhD candidate from Lanzhou University in China, and she's also working on a mutual PhD with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. She's studying climatology in a joint program between those two institutions with her Bachelor's of Science in Atmospheric Science and a Master's in Science from Climatology at Lanzhou. Her research area is semi-arid climate change, more particularly studying temperature increases in arid and semi-arid regions, which have seen the fastest increases in the past century. She is especially interested in the Northern Hemisphere, that's us, making the dry lands even drier with the climate changes that have occurred. In China, Ruixia has been working with thermodynamic processes mainly related to greenhouse gases, aerosol emissions, and local anthropogenic forces. The dry lands in China are facing warming as well as the fastest population growth in the country. Yet, globally, dry lands face less water, more evaporation, more population, and it's leading to desertification. She's co-authored a number of publications in international journals, and here at NCAR, she's studying climate change models in order to understand the drying areas and to study the precipitation changes in mid-latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. When she's not watching those models and measuring the humidity and precipitation, she also gets things up in the air because she loves to play badminton. So, Guo, please.
Can you hear me? Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. I'm very happy to be here to communicate with you. my name is Ruixia, and I'm now a PhD candidate in Nanjing University in China. Now I'm visiting the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder. My major is climate change, and my research is focused on the climate change in dryland. So next I will discuss the climate change that happened over the dryland. Dryland is a special area. It's defined as the regions where the precipitation is counterbalanced by the evaporation from the land surface and the transpiration in the plants. And the dryland can be divided into four subtypes. that are hyper-arid regions, arid regions, and the semi-arid regions, and the dry sub-humid regions. So there are four levels of the dryland. Dryland covers about 41% of the global land, so it's a bigger, it's a huge area. As we all know, the dry land is short of water, so its environment is very fragile. Its soil is infertile, so the vegetation cover is sparse, and the ecosystems are fragile, and so it is very sensitive to the global climate change. As we all know, the global warming is an important indicator of the global climate change. However, the global warming has not been uniform in the world, but with marked regional differences. The wet regions and the dry lands have very different temperature changes in the past century. Our research found that the temperature increase is more significant in drylands than in wet regions. For global average, the temperature increase is especially enhanced in the semi-arid regions. For the global average, our research found that the semi-arid regions contributed to more than 40% of the global warming. So the semi-arid enhanced warming is very important. In addition to the temperature increase in the dry land, another significant change of dry land is the drying chain. So we all know that the dry land is limit of water. And because of the temperature increase, the evaporation is also increasing. So most of the dry lands in the world show the significant dry chain, but not all the dry lands, most of the dry lands. Some of the dry lands also show the wetting chain, but only very little dry lands. So, in addition to the dry chain, for the global average, the global dry land area has been expanded in the past half century. And we did the projection of the global dry land area. It will increase, the expansion of dry land will increase in the future if the temperatures continue to increase. We did two projections based on two different greenhouse gas emission scenarios. One is representative concentration pathways 8.5. 8.5 is the highest greenhouse gas emissions scenarios. That means the greenhouse gas emission continue to rise throughout the 21st century. In this scenario, we found that the dry land will continue to expand. And in the end of the 21st century, the dry land area will expand by 23%, and this equals to 56% of the global land area. We did another projection based on the representative concentration pathways of 4.5. 4.5 means that the greenhouse gas emission will continue and will peak around the year of 2040, and then the greenhouse gas emission will decrease until the 21st century. In this scenario, we project that the dry land area will expand about 12%, and in the end of the 21st century, the 50% of the land surface will be covered by the dry land. So if we don't control the greenhouse gas emission, our planet will not only become warmer, but half of our planet will covered by the dry land. So it's not good. And the enhanced warming in dry land will lead to the evaporation and further result in a dry change in the dry land. So the dry change will also constrain the plant growth in this area. We all know that the photosynthesis is an important process that absorbs the CO2. The dry change will lead to the plant depression, plant growth depressed. That means the photosynthesis process is depressed. So less CO2 will be absorbed by the plant, and more CO2 will be emitted into the atmosphere. So in this case, the atmosphere will be more warmer. In another side, we find that the soil organic carbon storage, the ability of the soil organic carbon storage will decrease in the condition of temperature increase and the soil moisture decrease. So the warming and the dry chain will lead to more CO2 emitted into the atmosphere and will lead to less carbon storage in the soil. So this is a positive feedback. In this feedback, more CO2 will be emitted to the atmosphere. So the warmer, the drier. Of course, this is a global warming condition. There are some special areas that's different. So if we don't control the greenhouse gas emission, that's they will make our dry lands more drier and more warmer. In addition to the temperature change and the aridity change, we also investigate the population change in dry land. Because we all know that the human activities absolutely have responsibility for the climate change. So we investigate the population change in the dry land, and we found that dry lands burden about 38% of the global population. And meantime, the population growth is growth is rapidly in dry land. So the growth population means more human activities in the dry land. So in this case, the drying, the warming, and the more human activities will speed up the environment, become more fragile. So, and this will exacerbate the risk of degradation and desertification in dry land. So if we don't control the greenhouse gases, if we don't control the greenhouse gas emissions, our dry land will be very risk of the degradation and the desertification. We need to control that to protect our earth in the future. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. She sounds like she's going to cook us. Our next speaker this afternoon is Yingxia Jiang. She has a Bachelor of Atmospheric Science from Chengdu University of Information and Technology in Chengdu. And she's currently simultaneously working on her master's and doctoral degrees in atmospheric physics and environment with NCAR and the Northwest Institute of Eco-Environment and Resources and the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Yixiang has been working with permafrost conditions impacted by climate change and associated hazards using the NOAA MP land surface models in three sites in Tibet, and she has developed an erosion model for Aleutian desertification in central Tibet. She has authored and co-authored papers about model simulation as well as wind in the central Tibetan plateau, presented at the American Geophysics Union fall meeting about wind erosion simulations. And these were along the Qinghai-Tibet Railway and the response to climate change as the warming climate conditions contribute to permafrost melting. Her current study is about improving the snow cover simulation of land surface models in Tibet. The Qinghai-Tibet Plateau is related to the formation of the Asian monsoon and the total of the Northern Hemisphere climatology. Tibet is experiencing faster warming than the global average at the same latitudes, and this is an important study site for that reason. She is also interested in the cropland to forest project along the Yangtze River, which is the largest ecological project in the world. It comprises over half the land size of China, and governments of more than 10 provinces have stated that they are willing to restart this reforestation project. So I'm going to turn this over to Yingxia, and she's going to tell us about what happens with permafrost and climate change.
Good afternoon. Thanks to Anne and thanks to Risha. Thanks to Risha's talk, her talk is about the dry dynamics expanding in all over the world. It's because of it's getting warmer and getting drier, and the population is growing. But the situation in Tibet is vastly different, because the most part of Tibet is semi-arid and arid region, which is also dry land. But in this region, according to major researchers, this region is getting wetter, although it's also getting warmer, but it's getting wetter and greener. So it's different. But there is still a new part of Tibet in the east, which is semi-humid region, is getting drier. The same with Risha's results. And the desertification is mainly identified by two factors: the land degenerations and the sand activities. Because the most researchers is concerned about the land degenerations, which is like the vegetation degeneration and the climate change. So my work mainly focuses on the sand activities, because the sand activity is so hard to observe in Tibet. There is not enough observation data available to analyze this condition. So we used a land surface model combined with a wind erosion model to simulate how much soil is moved by the wind, which is kind of the sand activity. So, and all the results shows, the model is applied to 8 sites near the Qinghai Tibetan Railway, because this part has a very serious sand hazard and threatening the railway safety. So our results shows that all sites present a significant decrease trend for the soil move. And from 1979 to 2012, and it's mainly caused by the decreased strong wind and the increased precipitation and soil moisture. We also found that the slow cover and the vegetation coverage is very important to the wind erosion. But the model is not able to provide a very reliable results for both of them. So for the vegetation, we used a sensitivity experiment and the experiment shows the soil loss increase very stable with the decreased vegetation before the vegetation decreased 60%, but if the vegetation decreased more than 60%, the soil loss will go very fast, extremely fast. I mean, it's before the 60% it will go this way, but if the vegetation is decreased more than 65%, it will far go extremely in this way. So it's a threshold value we should pay attention to. And for the slow cover, I mean, I'm still working on it. So this is the main work I done in atmosphere and in NCAR now. So I didn't get the result yet. I hope I can get some interesting results. Thank you.
How many here have been to Tibet or in the plateau, been on the train across? Not many. You should do it. It's a great trip, and you would see these plateaus for yourself. They're not unlike some of our grasslands, but they are absolute triggers for understanding the environment. Our next speaker is going to take us into the more urban areas. Her name is Xiaoyu Xu. And Xiaoyu is a joint PhD candidate with NCAR and Nanjing University of Information Science and Technology in Nanjing, China. Currently, she's studying urban meteorology with Nanjing University of Information Science and Technology, and also holds a Master of Meteorology from the Chinese Academy of Meteorological Sciences and her Bachelor of Atmospheric Science. Her experience has addressed the urban heat island effect on building energy consumption for heating and cooling in Beijing. And she has analyzed the influence of El Nino on snow depth over the Qinghai Xinjiang Plateau, that's up in Tibet, and its continuity. The snowpack there leads to anomalous heating of the downstream flow from May through August, which in turn affects the environment downstream. She has participated in international workshops on high impact weather research and has been the lead author on articles related to simulation, analysis, and assessment of heating within the outdoor environment as well as within the urban heat island. Currently, she is assessing impacts of urban heat islands and impacts on building energy consumption to improve the heating and cooling energy consumption and waste release and the interaction between building energy consumption and microclimate under different climate change scenarios. And all of us are sitting in a Leeds building here, so it is a low energy intake building, but let's think about what have we got in here for air as well and what's happening with that. She's our local expert on that today. So here we go.
Okay, thank you, Anne. And thank you for coming here. I'm very honored to be here to be a guest speaker to talk about what I'm doing at NCAR and what I know about the climate change in China. Good afternoon. I'm Xiaoyu Xu, majoring in urban meteorology. And I've been visiting NCAR since last September. And here at NCAR, I'm mainly focusing on the interaction between the weather conditions, referring to the urban heat island in my study, and building energy consumption, as well as its corresponding waste heat release in urban Beijing. One thing I want to explain is urban heat island. It means a significantly warmer city center than its surrounding rural areas due to human activities. Different from the two previous speakers, my research focuses on a much smaller spatial scale, about several tens of kilometers in general, or sometimes up to a few hundred kilometers, like Beijing City. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change makes it plain that the current and projected climate change is not simply a natural variation, but very likely, meaning at least 90%, the result of human activities. For example, land surface modifications from natural vegetated surface to the artificial impervious surface, factory production processes, vehicles, and buildings. Most of these human activities are concentrated in cities. And according to the newly revised World Urbanization Prospects, about 54% of the world's population were living in cities by 2014. This percentage is projected to be 66% in 2050, 90% of which will be concentrated in Asia and Africa. Beijing, the target city in my study, is an international metropolis with approximately 20 million people and has been experiencing rapid urbanization and expansion in recent decades. On average, the urban heat island in density, which is represented by the air temperature difference between urban and rural sites, is about 3 to 4 Celsius degrees, and a bit stronger in winter than in summer. My main conclusion is that in urban Beijing, the urban heat island will increase the air conditioning, electric energy consumption for cooling in summer, especially during the heat wave events, posing a great challenge to the electrical load management and public health. Actually, in the context of global warming, the extreme weather and climate events, including heat wave, occur more frequently than before. And currently, many mitigation measures against urban heat island have been proposed and carried out. One typical example in China is Green Roof in Chengdu, the Panda City. If you have an opportunity to walk around the downtown of Chengdu City, you may find a lot of vegetated roofs covered with grass or small trees, that is called green roof, which can decrease the overlying air temperature by reducing absorbed solar radiation and increasing evaporation. By the way, the development of green roof in Beijing is limited, because of less precipitation and very cold winter there, which makes it too expensive to maintain. In brief, our country and people are making great efforts to fight against climate change or air pollution or urban heat island. Many related regulations have been issued and implemented. Later, the next speaker will tell you more. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We might not live in an extreme heat island here, but this has been studied in North America as well as many other places in the world because it does receive an impact from climate change. It gets hot, we turn on the air conditioners. If it's cold, we turn on the heaters. Those, in turn, heat up the environmental air. Our final speaker today is Fong Bu. She holds a Master of Chemical Engineering and Technologies from Dalian University of Technology, and she works for the BAIM company in Beijing in China. She's a visiting scholar in the CU Department of Civil, Environment, and Architectural Engineering, and her interests are outdoor and indoor air pollution and the transfer of infectious diseases. here to study state-of-the-art techniques and technology in air pollution resources and treatment. She's also studying contaminant monitoring. Her experience is analysis and development of environmental impacts of pollution using balanced methods and chemical analysis. She has researched the pollution produced by processes and equipment in the machinery and electronics industries, for example, electroplating, as well as industrial waste gas. Fong has also participated in research and authored papers about environmental impacts and clean production in major publications throughout the world. So here is Fong Wu.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for your attention on my partner's speech. Different from what they are doing on climate change as a PhD student, I have been working for 6 years in a government-owned company in Beijing, China. My name is Fang Bo. I'm a researcher in China Aerospace Energy Conservation and Environmental Protection Center. Now I'm here, a visiting scholar in CU. My research focus is on energy saving and environmental protection techniques for enterprises, helping them to meet the regulations installed by the Chinese government. I came to the US with the goal of eliminating the CO2 emission and improve the air quality in my country so that my fellow citizens can enjoy a better quality of life. My goal today is to give you a general overview of where all the multiple ways that Chinese is tackling with climate change. For that, I will tell you a story. I just picked this story from all the companies that we worked for. I have a friend called Jia. She works in an iron and steel plant in China. Her company oversees the major iron and steel plants all over China. So her company plays a major role in Chinese steel sector. And her company providing the resources that to maintain needed to maintain China's steady growth. However, in the last decade, the whole iron and steel industry have been exceeding the demand for iron and steel. That is a big problem, since it directly reduced the profit of the plants. That also varies every time she files for the budget for the energy saving and environmental programs. With a decrease in profits, the eliminating of outdated and energy consumption equipment and the environmental concern appear in the bottom line of the priorities in most of the companies. But that doesn't change the Chinese commitment in fighting the climate change. In fact, China government implemented a policy in order to make the company invest a larger portion of their revenue in protecting the environment. In 2005, the China National Development and Reform Commission issued the iron and steel industry development policy. The key points are adjusting industry structure, reducing the factory numbers, and investing in more advanced plants. With that, the Chinese government hopes to reduce the iron and steel surplus. This way leaves the companies with more profits to invest or more advanced technology and higher efficiency energy consumption matters that are imperative to China's growth. Since the implementation of this policy, the energy consumption of per ton steel per metric ton of stainless steel equivalent required to drop to 0.76 by 2005 and 0.73 by 2010 and 0.70 by 2020. In order to survive and develop, her company adopted a series of measures to meet government regulations. From 2002 to 2013, her company's cumulative investment on energy saving and environmental programs was $2 billion. With that, also implementing more than 140 projects, while also gradually eliminating all the outdated small smelting rolling equipment, including the old coke ovens, small blast furnaces, and the old electric furnaces. From 2010 to 2050, her company reduced their energy consumption by 0.50 million of tons of stainless coal, also the equivalent of 0.47 million tons of carbon dioxide. In recent years, her company launched a heat recovery project by reusing the heat from the processing progress. More than 17 million square meters of the residential area was benefited from this project, while also eliminating the needs for the coal-burned boilers as a heating source. This showcases the commitment that Chinese industry not only adhere to the Chinese policy, but also to benefit the citizens' life. Her company is only one company among many others that are doing their role to aid the Chinese government in their endeavors to tackle the environmental problems. The Chinese government is gradually strengthening the energy consumption and pollutant emission standards, obligating the enterprises to meet the regulatory requirements. Under the efforts of the government, enterprises, and the researchers, Chinese enterprises will survive in their effort to mitigate the global climate change. Thank you.
Thank you, Fang. We have some questions from the audience now that I will read to the panelists and we'll see what they have to say about this. The first question, is it true that China is building 150 new coal-powered power plants, coal-fired power plants? 150 new coal-fired power plants. Is China building those? Is it true that China is building 150 new coal-fired power plants?
Coal-fired?
But that means they're using coal to make power.
No, we're reducing that.
We have to change it into the natural gas now.
So they're not building new ones?
Not coal in China.
Yeah, okay. Good.
I'm not sure this 150 new coal-fired power plants are located in which province. Actually, China now implied lots of advanced technology. We gradually to eliminating the coal burn plants. We in Beijing we use more clean gases. We use the gas as the power for the plant.
Thank you. This is for Xiaoyu. In which year was 66% of humans live in cities? Did you say that?
Yeah.
Do you know which year? What year was that?
You mean the reference?
Yes, in what year?
According to the newly revised World Urbanization Prospects, this percentage will be 66% in 2050.
2050, correct? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, 2050.
Okay.
Good.
Okay.
The next question, China exceeds the USA in solar energy. Can you tell us how that helps curb pollution from coal-fired power plants?
In other words, if we use solar energy, how does that take away from the pollution from coal?
As we all know, the solar energy is clean, but the coal-fired power plants, when they are working, they use the coal for the combustion. So the coal-fired power plants, they emit lots of exhaust gases like fine particles, and we will see, and SO2 and NOx. Yeah, there are lots of these kind of plants, but the soil energy is clean, so we use solar energy also.
Okay.
All right, here's one. Anybody up here can answer this.
Uh-huh.
Solar radiation management, called SRM. The United States and Canada SRM expert David Keith recently stated that while neither the United States nor any other Western government has an SRM research program or budget, China does have a small solar radiation management program. Do any of you know anything about that? The Solar Radiation Management Program. Do you know anything about that?
No. I'm sorry.
No, you don't know about that. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, maybe we do.
Okay. No, I don't know anything about the solar radiation management, but in my hometown, wind turbines are common to generate electricity, it's a kind of clean energy, just like the solar energy, right? So this is what we try to develop a system.
Well, in my hometown there, we also use the solar energy. Because we use solar energy to heat the water, to have shower, and we have the lights, and then using the solar energy. But the problem is, in my province, the sunny days is maybe just 1 month, the whole year. This is the funny part. I could not understand why they use the solar, energy. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, this is from Brian, a student who asks, are any electrical cars being mass produced in China? Tell us about those.
Electric cars.
Electric cars. We don't drive cars.
Um, more and more Chinese began to use electrical cars. My colleagues, many of my colleagues, they buy electrical cars. In China, there is a big electrical car factory or company called BYD. They have the higher techniques. They can just produce the high efficiency electric car. And most cities have a policy that if you buy a electric car, the government will repay you maybe 10% or 10% or 20% of the whole money. So that is also a motion for the people to buy the electrical cars.
What I want to add is that the electrical bicycles are very popular in China because sometimes there will be traffic jams in big cities, but the electrical bicycles can make you go through so many cars, and many parents choose the electrical bicycles in my city to pick up their children when their class is over. Thank you.
Well, my dad has a unique tricycle bike, and we usually use it. I mean, a lot of people in China prefer the unique tricycle bike because you don't need to worry about the traffic jam. So there is a lot if you go to China.
There's a question here. Does the field of environmental economics exist in China as it does in the U.S.? The example is that economic values can be assigned to environmental factors, such as just looking at trees or walking in a park, that you are in the environment and that has a value. Do you have a program in China that measures this with economics, as we do here, so that open areas, for example, have value? That's
cool. Open public. Open park. Okay. We have the open parks some cities. Our new house is built. We got a new house in Chengdu. We have next to our house is a very big park. It's open to the public. If you go through the first site of the park and go through the whole park, you need 2 hours to walk out. So it's very huge. It's along the river, and all my neighbors will take a walk when they have after the dinner. So, thank you.
Can you measure the economic value, like it's worth 5,000 yuan, for example, to take a walk in the park? Is there a way to measure the economic value of that park in China? Do you have a study that does this?
No. I don't know, I missed.
Okay, guess not. Okay, another question here. In recent years, there's been a push for efforts to slow down the progression of climate change. Let me see what this says. How big of an effort, of an effect can actually be seen by this? Can you see that it's slowing down the desertification? Can you see this?
By planting trees.
Okay, because most desertification areas in China is grassland, so we can't grow trees in very dry areas. In grassland, it's not good. It's not that efficient, I mean. We have some programs planting trees maybe 10 or 20 years ago along the Inner Mongolia and between the Inner Mongolia and the Beijing, and it's in the north part. But we But I think the most efficient way that Chinese government do for the gasification is they make the rules for the limitations of the animals people could have. That means the cows and the sheep in the grass, in a certain grassland is limited, and then which keeps the vegetation grow and so the desertification is not as serious as before. This rule is published maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and after the rule is published, the grass, it's the area of the Inner Mongolia is getting greener, according to the researchers. Okay, thank you.
And the question is, there are some efforts to slow down the progress of climate change. I know in the plants, like the factories, actually the CO2 emission has a tight relationship with the energy consumption. If we can reduce the energy consumption, then we equally reduce the CO2 emission. So in China, Chinese government, they are stressing the policy of energy consumption. For the new program, you need to use the high efficiency energy equipment. And for the old equipment, the plants or the enterprises need to make a plan to eliminate the backward equipment to exchange to the high efficiency energy use equipment that can also reduce the energy consumption, that the same result and reduce the CO2 emission.
We have about 5 questions here that all basically ask, how seriously is the Chinese government treating climate change? And is China more serious about this, taking care of climate change, than the United States government? You've been here for a few months now, and maybe you've seen the news, and maybe this is too political and you don't want to answer, but think about this. Is the Chinese government taking this issue very seriously? Is it just an economic issue, or are there other issues involved? Maybe we can have a little discussion about that. Let's start with Boo.
Yes, Chinese government take very serious on the climate change. They have many. Many methods to, they have done many struggles for the climate change, for prevent the climate change. As far as I know, but I don't know much about the policy. As far as I know, the government plant many trees as they can. I live in the western part of China. Dryland. So many plant trees have been planted in these years. Except for this, we also developed the new energies, including the solar energy, the wind energy, the use of natural gases instead of burning coal. And we also control the cars in a day. Some cars come to go today, and some cars can. Also, we change the heating way in winter. Now the heating is concentrated instead of the previous the small heating regions. The concentrated heating will emission will emit less CO2 into the atmosphere. So I think Chinese government have struggled for the climate change seriously. Thank you.
I also think the Chinese government take it seriously before start years ago, since because when I'm in primary school, there is a project about planting trees along the Yangtze River, because my hometown is near the Yangtze River, so I know this project very well. They return or not field nets to the forest. And the government give the tree small trees to the farmers and them to plant to their field nets instead of growing. It starts from when I was in primary school, so it's years ago. To control the to make the environment along the river gets better, because the Yangtze River is one of the most important river in China. So, thank you.
Our government takes seriously about fighting against climate change. As you may know, air pollution seems happen more frequently than here. We have to balance the environmental management and the economic development now, because the air pollution or anything else can have for damage our health and economic development. So we have to pay attention to this and take action now. Thank you.
From my perspective, I think China has already done lots of actions to mitigate climate change. I want to say is this from two points. The first is I know in the industry several years ago we began to the sell to a trade system. The government just sets a higher level that some heavily polluted industry they should meet this level of energy use. So if you exceed this level, you need to buy the CO2 emission possibility or something like that. Yeah, you can't use the energy by whatever you want to use. You need to use in a range. Then if you want to use more, you need to pay a much more higher price. So that is a matter that can reduce the energy use and the CO2 emission. The second is, as everyone knows, the China suffers from bad air quality. So that is the most important problem that Chinese government need to solve, maybe in recent years. But it is really hard. So to solve the energy pollution problems, there's lots of things need to do. Chinese government try to adjust the industry structure. We eliminate lots of backward industries and close lots of small, heavy polluted plants like coal mining plants. I was born in a coal-rich province. When I was young, there are lots of small coal mine plants. Now when I come back now, the small coal mine plants was closed. Only the bigger one was still exist, because the small coal plants have a heavy pollution because they don't have the exhausted gas clean equipment. That is also a way. Through the this adjust industry structure, the heavily polluted plants were closed. The Chinese government also tried to control the transportation because the cars emitted lots of VOC. That VOC is also a major reason for the air pollution. So the Chinese government also control the cars you can use every day on the road. So this is also a way to reduce the energy consumption. It's also a way to mitigate the climate change. Thank you.
Does the Chinese government advertise for people to use less energy on television or billboards?
Yes. Yes.
Advertise.
Yes.
Advertising. What do they have? What do they have?
We may have a slogan on the bus envelope saying
planting more trees.
Planting more trees, something like that. And I remember exactly it's about the slogan in our canteen on the wall, just saying.
Say it in Chinese, it's okay.
Don't waste food.
Yeah.
I think this is a way to save energy and. Respect our labor.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Thank you.
I remember a logo that says have less children and plant more trees.
Okay, here's a little question. I heard some cities in China place limits on owning a second home. Do you think this is a helpful step to help climate change, or do you even know about these restrictions
so that you can have only one house?
One
house? Do you know about this?
Chengdu has it.
Not really. My colleagues, they have maybe four or three or five houses.
They're rich. Well, there is some kind of this rules that you can't own two houses, but if you are rich, you don't care that rule because there is some policy, but it's all just about money.
This is about the last question here. The question is about nuclear power plants and also about long-range transmission lines. The question is, how many nuclear power plants are currently being built in China? And secondly, do you know anything about the batteries to hold the electricity from, say, the Gobi Desert wind farms so they don't have to go in the long transmission lines to get into the grid? Do you know about that? Do you know about nuclear power plants first?
No.
Nuclear power plants. Do you know about any of those?
No.
These are climate change people, and they don't know all these variations of things, and we don't either.
Sorry.
How about batteries? Do you know about batteries? Because, you know, to take from the Gobi Desert wind farm all the way to Chengdu is a long way.
Yeah.
So how do you do that?
Well, as I know, it's still a problem to store the energy caused by the wind. So it's well, we have or not wind.
Wind turbines.
Yeah, we have or not wind turbines in in Xinjiang province and Gansu province, or near the coast where the wind is strong, but this energy is hard to use, and as it's hard to restore because it's very unstable, so it's not easy to storage. So it's still a problem. Maybe some of you can solve it.
One last question here. The Himalayan glaciers provide a large percentage of the flow of the Yangtze and the Yellow Rivers for a percentage of the year. To offset some of the glacial loss, many reservoirs are being built, Three Gorges Dam and some other reservoirs. However, is it true that the reservoirs cannot supplant all the glacial loss? In other words, do they hold enough water to take care of that if there's rainfall? And if so, are you aware of any time projections when the Yangtze may first be dry? There will be no water in the dry season. How soon will China dry up?
Wow. From Tibet. It's a big question.
Well, it's a too big question. Well, my group is doing some this kind of work. We do some works and prediction the weather. In 100 years, to say what's going on in 100 years, but you know the models does a good work in 7 days, but for 1 year it's hard to believe the results, and for 100 years it's incredible. It's hard to say how accurate it is. So it's hard to say, just no. Join in. Here.
Okay.
I think we owe these four young women a very big thank you. They are here being supported by the Chinese Academy of Sciences, the Chinese government, their respective universities, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and our own CU Environmental Engineering Department. There's a lot of collaboration going on. I think we don't hear about this from our government these days, but there is a lot going on. And I think that it's very important for us to recognize that these are international efforts. All of us are on the same planet. And we need to solve these problems together. And I think that all of them have been very wonderful today. They haven't presented very often, so this was a bit of a scary endeavor for them, but I think they did a very nice job, and I want to thank them again for this conference.